is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 5, a British woman is being deported from Malaysia after she pleaded guilty to posing naked on a sacred mountain. Eleanor Hawkins was sentenced to 3 days in jail, which was set against time already served. Her father, Tim, gave this statement about her court appearance.
We think the sentence is appropriate and fair for the offence committed. I'm grateful that the Malaysian authorities reached this decision. Eleanor knows what she did was wrong, disrespectful, and she is deeply sorry for any offence she's caused to the Malaysian people.
A children's cancer doctor who abused 18 boys in his care has had his 22-year jail sentence restructured. It means Miles Bradbury could serve less time in jail, but will face more stringent measures to prove if he can be released. The police watchdog won't carry out an inquiry into trouble between South Yorkshire Police and striking minors 31 years ago. Officers were accused of using excessive force in Rotherham in 1984. Hundreds of people have paid their respects to the former Lib Dem leader Charles Kennedy at his funeral in Fort William. He died last week, aged 55, from a problem related to alcoholism, as Kevin Gover reports.
A piper played a lament as the coffin left St John the Evangelist Church in Coole near Fort William. Those paying respect included his Lib Dem colleague, Sir Min Campbell.
It's a sad occasion, but in a sense it was an uplifting occasion as well.
David Green was Mr Kennedy's former researcher.
What I remember him for was his wit, his humour. Even in the darkest times, he was someone who could make us all laugh.
For famous faces, there was no seat at the front. Senior politicians, including Gordon Brown and Nick Clegg, joined people from the village, all united in their grief and respect.
The ex-leader of the IMF, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, has been cleared of organising events with prostitutes. The trial hinged on sex parties in several countries. That's the latest. I'm Simon English.
BCFM, BCFM.
Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Former UNHCR operative in Yemen, Judith Brown, is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, top of the agenda, TTIP and TPP at Bilderberg. These trade deals that let corporations sue governments if the laws hurt their profits, otherwise known as the privatisation of democracy. Ever wonder why what our governments do benefits big corporations and not us? Our future's been decided for us this weekend over in Austria at the annual Bilderberg Conference, where the elite of the West consolidate their plans to extend their power over the next year and give instructions to the pliable politicians as to how they want our taxpayers' money spent. This year's Bilderberg meeting is taking place in an interesting region of Europe, supposedly neutral Austria. But the corporation with most staff there is actually Google, reflecting the criminal elite's increasing intent in owning and controlling technology, the so-called technocracy. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, can you just describe Bilderberg to us? And why is it that we have so little reporting of it on the mainstream press, even though the richest people in the world are there?
Well, it's a group that was set up at the end of World War II to coordinate between the Western European and American elites. And at first, it was very secretive. It met first in the Bilderberg Hotel in Oosterbeek in the 1950s.
Well, it's Oosterbeek in Holland, yeah, which is a part of Arnhem. Now, the connection really is fascinating, which is that it's a kind of hint back to a battle that took place there 10 years before in the exact same spot as the first Bilderberg meeting took place.
Indeed, and one of the founders of Bilderberg, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, was actually a very interesting character, married Queen Juliana, and he was actually an SS officer. who married Queen Juliana of the Netherlands, and then supposedly, halfway through the war, he changed sides and became an Allied supporter after the German invasion of Holland. He then was imposed by Churchill in particular on Montgomery as an advisor for Operation Market Garden.
I know his security credentials were signed by Ian Fleming, the famous Bond
indeed,
author, weren't they?
Indeed.
And Ian Fleming was instructed what to do by King George VI.
Indeed, and Morton, who was the original model for C in the Bond books, and the suspicion is,
isn't it M in M. the Bond books? Yeah, you're talking about Major Desmond Morton.
Yes,
yeah.
I am. Yes, M, sorry, not C.
And they had a thing called M Section. Basically, it was a little private thing operated by Churchill and the King, their private little section of MI6 that could do anything it wanted, and the rest of MI6 even didn't know what they were doing.
Well, indeed, and Paul Manning, who was a top US journalist in the war, eventually wrote a book at the end of the war called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, where he demonstrated pretty conclusively to those who read the book, which came out in the 80s, that Bormann in fact escaped from Berlin to Argentina, where he then continued to run a Nazi operation in collaboration basically with the NATO intelligence services.
So this goes quite a long way to explaining what happened to all that looted Nazi gold.
Indeed.
And the billions really that the Nazis had.
And there's
the
another
the
very
war.
Interesting book related to this, which is called OpJB by Andrew Creighton.
Christopher Creighton.
Christopher Creighton, but that was only his pen name. His real name was John Ainsworth Davis, and he was the young Royal Navy commando who led the expedition into Berlin to extract Bormann, and then Bormann was then, under the protection of MI6, taken to Argentina. And I think if you look back to that era of the creation of Bilderberg, in the most post-war period, and the setting up of NATO, there was very much an under-the-table deal done between leading Nazis like Bormann and the NATO infrastructure, and it goes a long way to explain the way that NATO operates today.
Well, as we explained last week, Adolf Heutzinger was Hitler's chief of staff. In fact, he was sitting a few places away from Hitler at the bomb plot in 1944, when there was an attempt to blow Hitler up unsuccessfully, and then he was actually then drafted in the early 1950s as the chief of staff of NATO, straight out of the same role in the Nazi regime.
Indeed.
Into NATO.
And so the same with Reinhard Gehlen, who was the head of the Gestapo in Eastern Europe and then becomes the head of the BND, the West German Intelligence Services, or Klaus Barbie, who eventually was put on trial in France by the French police, but was actually employed by the Americans to train the Bolivian army in torture techniques. The linkages between Nazi intelligence operatives and Western intelligence services is intimate. And, of course, the implication is that the possibility exists that the Battle of Arnhem was, in fact, fixed by these forces working.
Yeah, the other person involved in Arnhem is, of course, Lord Carrington, who's still alive, just about, and he was actually involved in the ground force that successfully, due to the American assault, took the bridge at Nijmegen, which was one bridge away in the Bridge Too Far film, in the reality of the battle, from the Arnhem Bridge. But then his tanks just stopped for 18 hours, until the British had been wiped out by the Germans in Arnhem, and then they tried to move on, by which time, of course, the Germans had got plenty of reinforcements.
Well, also, it's quite clear that the Germans knew the Allied order of battle, and that's possibly related to Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands being a double agent, and others involved, like King Kong.
This is the spy that Bernhard sent in. Now, this is one of the key little parts of all of this jigsaw puzzle, is that this guy was sent in with the knowledge of the Brits to liaise with the Dutch resistance, wasn't he? And it turned out afterwards, although Bernhard had said this guy's fantastic, actually he was a German spy, and he took the plans to the Abwehr.
Which is why there was an SS Panzer division there that shouldn't have been there.
Yeah, it's a bit of an accident. Actually, two recuperating SS Panzer divisions just happened to turn up.
And, of course, the purpose behind this was to slow up the Allied advance into Germany so that Bormann could fix for all of the Nazi wealth, essentially, the gold, the looted artworks, everything, to be put in safe keeping for the joint use of the follow-on structure that was being created, which was actually a merger between NATO intelligence services and selected parts of the Nazi intelligence infrastructure.
Okay, well, we'll be talking more about that in the second hour, and possibly before that again, because it really is the big event of the moment. It was completely contrast with the press attention given to the G7 conference. Thousands of journalists given schmoozed and given free food, free booze, you know, really looked after. And then all of a sudden you've got a situation where there's a handful of journalists and they're being seriously harassed just 20 miles away where the real deal is happening just after the G7.
Well, as I say, the first Bilderberg meeting was at the Bilderberg Hotel in Istabika, which was actually inside the Kessel in which the British paratroops were eventually captured.
So anyway, I'd like to welcome to the studio to talk about something that's just a sort of obliquely related to all of this. I suppose the global war on terror, supposedly you might call it. But I mean, I'm a little bit I find it a bit difficult to explain why what's going on in what's going on in Yemen fits into that. But anyway, welcome Dr. Judith Brown to the studio again. You were here about 6 weeks ago. To talk about Yemen. Just explain, for those that didn't hear that, what's your connection? Because you were working, I think, for the UNHCR in Yemen.
On the UNHCR.
What were you actually doing over there?
I was the health coordinator for the refugee health program in Yemen.
And so what did that mean day to day?
It meant that, well, mostly I was negotiating contracts for refugees, because in Yemen, when people had got refugee status, the country was too poor to be able to provide healthcare, which most countries do when they have refugees. So they had this urban healthcare program. So I would negotiate with hospitals and clinics for care of refugees, costs, and negotiate for people who needed to have care overseas on an individual basis, in people who were ill with things like AIDS and TB.
Why did the UN choose you to go there? Had you had experience in Yemen? Could you speak languages, that sort of thing?
Well, no, I'd worked in South Lebanon, and I think at that point there probably wasn't that many people who wanted to go to Yemen, so the job fell to me.
Was it a bit tough over there then when you first arrived?
No, it was never tough, but there had been a recent terrorist attack. If you remember the Abu Hamza thing, you know, in South Yemen, where some tourists had been killed, and I think it made people feel very, very wary.
Well, I wonder if that was anything to do with MI6, because there was quite a lot of connections between Abu Hamza and the Finsbury Park Mosque and the intelligence services over
Absolutely,
here.
Absolutely, there was. Yeah.
So what's been happening in Yemen since the last time we spoke? Because at the time it was basically a bombing campaign going on by Saudi Arabia. I must say, I was appalled this morning listening to some of the BBC coverage to do with Saudi Arabia, and they were ignoring the war completely, and they were saying, oh, isn't it interesting how much money, and aren't they wonderful, the Saudis are spending on solar power and alternative energy. Great big puff piece about how wonderful the Saudis are, not mentioning the fact that they're bombing the hell out of a poor little defenceless country with our backing. So what's been going on?
Well, sadly to say, the situation's got much worse. The Saudis have been bombing everything. They said that they were going to bomb places where there were weapons, and of course most of those were the arsenal of the Yemeni army. The government is held captive in Riyadh, the Yemeni government, and so therefore they can only follow Saudi lines, and maybe they want to, I don't know.
So why did they go to Riyadh? Have they been captured?
The thing is they were offered asylum in Riyadh when the Houthis first of all, the government fled from Sana'a to Aden. Then when they were in Aden, the Houthis, the militias, started approaching Aden, and the Saudis offered the Yemeni government asylum. But of course, they've gone there. But once they're there, they're captive, because, you know, they can't choose anything. They have to say what their Saudi masters tell them to say. And certainly the Saudis would say that the government's asking them to carry the bombing out, but in effect it's a situation where they've bombed huge sections, huge cities have disappeared, Sa'ada in the north, they've bombed a water plant in Sana'a, they've bombed lots of antiquities and UNESCO site, a citadel in Taiz, which had some 10th century BC origins and an Ottoman fort built on top, has gone. It's disappeared. It took 3 days to bomb it. Parts of the old city in Sana'a have been bombed. Lots of other places, a museum in Damar, as well as places like all the airports. They started to bomb Hodeida when aid boats, aid shipments were coming in so that they couldn't dock there. I mean, it's just been sort of carpet bombing. And what I'm so amazed about is how it's not being reported on the news. Of course, the militias haven't been stopped by it at all. They're creating chaos, particularly in the very south of southwest part of Yemen, Aden, Taiz, and cities around that area like Lahaj. Lahaj has actually been completely demolished. It doesn't exist anymore by the militias. Parts of Aden, exactly the same. The photographs of it are really terrible. So it hasn't actually stopped the militias sort of still attacking, as part of the civil war scenario.
I wonder whether some people, maybe Channel 4 News, are thinking, well, this is a long way away. Why does it matter to a British audience?
Well, I think it matters, because I think that when we realise what a major disaster is not being reported, it makes you wonder what in the world isn't being reported. Secondly, it means that because it isn't being reported, both the militias and the Saudis can carry on without any constraints whatsoever. Our bombs that are being made in UK are being used by the Saudis in the bombing campaign. So, I think that we have a direct responsibility. Of course, we occupied South Yemen for 150 years and left it in a bit of a mess. So, we have a responsibility there. But I think the other thing is, if people think that it can't happen here, if you see how rapidly most of Yemen has been bombed and how little, in fact, virtually none of it is functioning now. I mean, they still have Damascus working in Syria. Sana'a isn't working at all. It's completely stopped.
So look, just draw the two sides for us. We've got rival presidents, haven't we, that were presidents. But I mean, who is kind of supporting each one? This is one of the things that I think the Western powers do quite a lot, is they create this conflict situation and then they start doing this horrible thing, which is hardening the sides. So
absolutely.
To begin with, you start getting people hating each other.
Absolutely.
And then you start getting people killing each other. And then everybody in Yemen has to start to choose which side they're on, even though they don't want to choose. They don't want to get involved. They have to start doing it. But anyway, so give us an idea of two sides.
The Houthis, who were a tribe on the boundary of Yemen, they initially, between 2004 and 2009, were really subject to genocidal attacks. They were originally called the Bakil tribe, but then when their leader, whose name was Hussein Houthi was actually killed, they changed their name to the Houthis.
Okay, so which president are they kind of supporting?
Well, interestingly enough, at the time it was President Saleh with Saudi money that was attacking them. But would you believe Saleh is now in league with the Houthis, providing them with the money that he got when he was deposed, when he resigned as president of Yemen, and he took half of Yemen's money with him, and he's now using that money.
So why the Houthis now changed their mind about Saleh? They thought he was awful. Now they think he's
absolutely
great.
They were the first tribe that, when there was the uprisings in 2011, they were the first tribe that came out to say that they didn't want, they wanted to depose Saleh. So yeah, he was why have they? But I suspect that what's happened is that he's just got an awful lot of money and he can afford to fund them, and so therefore they've decided that they'll go with him.
So is he a kind of quartermaster, basically just providing the weapons?
Oh, I think he wants to be president. Yeah, I think that he's using the Houthis because he sees that as his only chance to get back as being president.
And so who's
again?
The other president then?
The other president, the other president whose actually role is also a bit, you could say that he's a president and not a president, President Hadi, which people call him the president at the moment, but actually he was appointed for a 2-year term. Now that expired over a year ago.
Oh, right.
And this 2-year term was meant to be so that he could set up this, democratic system in Yemen and then sort of like write a new constitution, and then the then the people of Yemen would then vote on this new democracy. But they had a dialogue called the Yemen National Dialogue that went on. It overran. It went on for much longer than it was meant to. So Hadi stayed in power. Then Hadi resigned earlier this year, and then when he fled to Aden, he then reinstated himself. You could say that he had no right to reinstate himself. But however, Yemen was without.
So not only has his term of office run out, he's also resigned, but he still wants to be.
He still calls himself president, and people still say that he is the president.
So who are the troops that are fighting with him then? I mean, the Saudis supporting him.
Yes, definitely. I mean, the Saudis are saying that they're completely supporting him.
So the British and the Americans supporting him?
Absolutely, they are. I mean, I have read quotes by the British government to say that they're doing everything but actually being involved in the actual conflict, in the actual fighting.
Openly. Because they might well be doing some sort of covert operations. Yeah, they seem to do that quite a lot.
Absolutely. In fact, in the Guardian newspaper, it did say that there were British ships in the area. And also other people that are supporting him. There's the UAE, for example. There's Sudan. The Saudi have actually built a coalition of states.
The main Gulf states, which are the main allies of the US, or should we say client states of the US, really.
Yeah.
So what about on the ground? Who are the fighters?
Now, you see, that's quite interesting, because I think Saudi has actually tried to get ground troops on the ground. I mean, militarily, I'm not anyone who knows much about war, but I've certainly heard and read other people who claim to be sort of like military leaders say that a bombing campaign doesn't succeed on its own without ground troops. Well, there are no ground troops.
Depends what you want to do, doesn't it? Because, I mean, there was a bombing campaign against Libya. The result of it has been complete carnage and chaos. Mm. Maybe that's what they want in Yemen.
I think so. And on the ground, you've still got this basic sort of like civil war situation. I think that as you were saying, I think the Houthis, for example, when they were being killed, I was interviewed an editor from the Yemen Times, which is an English language paper. I think I told you about this last time, and she said that she was told not to report it. Well, therefore, other newspapers were also told not to report it. There was obviously a lot of misinterpretation. And by the time the Houthis appeared, they were a much hated group. They formed one bloc with all the other Zaydi tribes in Yemen. And depending on which statistics you read, they're somewhere around a third to 50% of the people in Yemen. So they're a good proportion. They're less than, they're not up to 50%. They are definitely less than half, but they're a good proportion of the Yemeni population. They're on one side. The people who, when you talk to Yemenis, they divide into two groups. There's people who think that what Saudi is doing is wonderful and Saudi is perfect, and there are people in Yemen who do that, and that the Houthis are terrible, and there are other people who think that the Houthis are perfect and the Saudis are terrible. The majority of people just want the fighting to stop. They just, you know, are sick of the fighting. I mean, even now, although it's only gone on for such a short time, but there are people sort of like entrenched in both sides that hold these like really strong
opinions. One of the aspects to all this, I mean, we keep hearing about ISIS destroying ancient ruins or, you know, historically very important sites. This is exactly what's happening in Old Sana'a, isn't it?
In Old Sana'a
These are historical sites in Yemen. They're just being bombed, and actually many of them are, there's no military value to these places.
No, absolutely. There's absolutely, in fact, you know, someone from the Yemeni government said that the reason why they bombed the UNESCO site to non-existence in Taiz was because it was a Houthi site, and they were hiding weapons there. But if you know the area and you know what's happening on the ground, nobody's going to go, you know, all the way up a mountain to hide the weapons on the top of the mountain, which is like a highly visible strategic spot. It's not going to happen. What was there was this place where people went for, you know, weekends and holidays and days out, sort of mostly Yemeni people. It was a tourist area, and it had been like that for maybe two or three decades. So it wasn't an area where there was any military bases. There are some citadels in some old cities that are left where the military have taken it over and have then made them into military camps. I'm talking about the Yemeni military before all of this war started. But this one, this this particular citadel wasn't an area.
Well, I'm just reading the UN saying, UNESCO saying, this site that they've been bombing is 10th century, Martin.
Yeah, 10th century BC.
Well, I mean, it's this kind of... when I was an aid worker in Bosnia, I went to Mostar, and of course the Croatian militias that were surrounding Mostar destroyed the old bridge there as a way of sending a signal about their intention.
So it's a sort of psychology. There's psychology to this. Like we're taking, basically destroying your history.
Mm. Yeah, it's the Baedeker raids in the Second World War when the Luftwaffe bombed Bath and so on. And of course, then the British responded by bombing Dresden, which was a famous old medieval town and so on. Mm. And I'm afraid this is part of modern warfare.
Judith, we haven't heard much about this in the media, so... what's your theory as to why not?
Well, I spoke to a friend of mine who's a journalist. He's a freelance journalist and he writes a lot of articles in the Middle East and some in UK, Sherif Nishashibi. He said that he's writing articles to journals and newspapers that have accepted 100% of everything that is written in the past, and he can't get anything printed at all on Yemen. He hasn't had one single article accepted. I wrote to the BBC on the day that they reported a bomb that had gone off in a mosque in Saudi Arabia, and I said, this is unequal coverage, you know, you haven't said anything about the bombs that are happening in Yemen. And they wrote back and said that it was completely untrue, that they'd reported Yemen fully. I'm going to put in an appeal against that. I've tried writing letters to newspapers. In the past, I've had maybe about 50% hit on when I'm writing to broadsheet. I haven't got a single letter in. So I think that for whatever reason, Yemen is completely off the cards.
Well, I mean, it looks like you have to almost have to go online to follow.
Absolutely.
It. I mean, there's a very good London-based Middle East Eye, it's called.
Yeah.
MiddleEastEye.net. And I met some of the journalists from that about sort of eight months a year ago. And that's doing extremely good coverage.
Yeah.
One of the articles Middle East Eye published just the end of last week was looking at Salah, and they're saying how he danced on the heads of the CIA.
Yeah.
He claims that Hani Mohammed Mahajad cannot be verified. What he said about his time as a foot soldier for Al-Qaeda and Waziristan tracks with what former director of counterintelligence for the CIA knew at the time, but no one can confirm the claim itself. He claims the war in terror is a Kafkaesque sham, empowering that which it seeks to destroy.
Well, I think that's becoming increasingly clear. In the past, we knew that the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, for example, have been armed, trained and directed by CIA MI6, and they blatantly did so. There's no any dispute about that. But and of course, that's supposedly where Al-Qaeda came from. But then, of course, in the recent years in Syria, we've seen exactly the same scenario played out, where ISIS clearly has been supported directly by NATO intelligence services, particularly the Turkish MIT. Now, the mainstream media simply cannot get people to understand what's going on here. They've put up a smokescreen of confusion. And to my mind, it's absolutely clear. Many people in the Middle East are much clearer about this than we are because they have a better information system.
Well, I have, but the difficulty in Yemen is that at the moment people are believing the side that they want to believe.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that I've found quite interesting, firstly, if you look at the tactics that Saudi are using against Yemen, capturing the government, bombing out all of the arsenal, and then sort of hitting the historic sites and carpet bombing people with very little media coverage. There's a lot of similarity in that. But also, there actually have been recorded meetings between Israel and Saudi Arabia, which might surprise some, but I suppose nothing surprises me anymore.
No.
And also, in Haaretz, it's reported that the forces that are still loyal to Hadi, that are fighting in Yemen, are actually now being armed with Israeli troops. They actually went into the Saudi embassy, the Houthis, they overran the Saudi embassy in Sana'a, And what they found there was lots of Israeli weapons being stored inside the Saudi embassy. And what's also quite interesting is that they found an article about Socotra. I don't know whether you know Socotra. I know, Tony, when I was here last time, I was like very adamant that this was a civil war. But, you know, there's never been a civil war when the great powers haven't jumped in and taken the advantage for themselves. Yeah. And this is just a case in question. Because Socotra is this, it's one of the top 10 UNESCO sites in the world. It's this island, and it's actually nearer to Somalia than it is to Yemen. But it guards it's highly strategic. It guards the route that's taken to the Red Sea, and all shipping has to pass between Socotra and Aden, you know, in order to go through Bab el-Mandab. Anyway, in, I think, 2010, Saleh took a lot of money from the Americans and agreed that they could actually have an airbase on there. But apparently now, its latest documents show that they not only want an airbase, but they also want to take it over. And these documents, they actually found in the Saudi embassy, which actually, seeing that there was these Israeli weapons plus these documents in the Saudi embassy, it really makes you see this sort of like axis of evil, to use George Bush's words, developing between Israel, Saudi, and USA, you know, which and they see dominating Yemen as being a means of doing that.
So that's an interesting strategic angle. But also, Martin, there is this kind of attempt. I mean, we're seeing this all over the world, aren't we? Important aspects of Islam under attack. This UNESCO site is described as a jewel of Islamic culture in Yemen. So, and British bombs and possibly two British aircraft being used to destroy it.
Indeed, and of course, but hardly any information getting out about it. And of course, at the same time, we're told. I mean, the pop singer or rock singer Brian Eno calls it propaganda. People only have a certain amount of time in a day to take in news. So what happens is we get told all sorts of things about irrelevant stuff, the, you know, X Factor or whatever.
Which celebrity is pregnant today.
And then the serious bit comes, and we're told Russia bad, Ukraine boo. There's a huge questions about the Mexican general election that's just taken place, about it being fraudulent, lots of people being killed. But have you seen anything on the BBC
about
that?
Absolutely not, no.
And of course, there's the basically certain things we're told to care about.
Yeah.
So we're told to worry about what's happening in eastern Ukraine to some extent.
Yeah.
Whereas other places we haven't heard anything. When was the last time you heard about what was going on in the Congo, for example?
Yeah, exactly.
Which of course goes on year in, year out as a miserable conflict, killing millions over the years. But
we're going to have a bit more about the sort of the more general thing in part two, which is this war on terror, a multi-dimensional war on terror. And Global Research's Michelle Chosadovsky has been talking about that this week, which I find fascinating. But what about the presence of ISIS in Yemen? Because I've heard some reports of that too.
Yeah, I've read some reports of that. Of course, you know, Al-Qaeda is still meant to be operating in Yemen, but Al-Qaeda is a very sort of like fluid thing, because a tribe that's sort of like goes and sort of like fights might sort of have a bit of money from Al-Qaeda, and they're sort of like Al-Qaeda one minute, and the next minute they're sort of like the tribe who lives in, you know, this area. So Al-Qaeda is very fluid in Yemen. But I think that what they don't have is this sort of like this notion of sort of, because of that, it's very, you could count the number of Al-Qaeda fighters sort of in low thousands, and that isn't a big enough number. In order to have a big enough number of sort of fighters to become ground forces to attack the Houthis, then yes, you might well have to sort of like develop something like ISIS, so that you actually then have a Shia militia and a Sunni militia fighting together. You know, what's quite interesting, talking about the Mujahideen, Martin, which you were talking about 2 minutes ago, but the two tribes that actually supported the Mujahideen in Afghanistan were the Hashids and the Bakils, the two biggest Shia tribes, and they went off to fight and came back. So although And of course, that was the start of Al-Qaeda. So although it was the start of Al-Qaeda, the people who went from Yemen were actually Shia. They weren't Sunni. Mm-hmm. And when they came back, they were used because, you know, it was just about the time of the Gulf War when, as far as the world was concerned, or the Western world was concerned, Yemen voted the wrong way. It didn't vote for the first Gulf War in 91, and Yemen was horribly punished then. But therefore the Yemeni government didn't have as much money as a lot of the tribes had, and so what the president did was actually to use the mujahideen that were returning to keep the tribes in order. So he actually was using their fighting spirit. And when in 1994, because the unification of Yemen was in 1990, and in 1994 he actually used the mujahideen to fight the South started a war of independence when they wanted the country back. He actually used the mujahideen to fight the South Yemenis because his own army wasn't big enough. So it's quite interesting, the sort of like the links between Saleh and the mujahideen and Al-Qaeda and Shia and Sunni, because it seems as if this sort of like, you know, it's all morphing all the time, and it becomes a different thing.
Yes, and also, of course, it isn't just autonomous. The Al-Qaeda is effectively a franchise of the CIA, in my view.
Yeah.
In other words, they create... ISIS is very clearly being created through the intelligence services in Turkey, in particular.
Yeah,
and they
Qatar
are part of NATO.
And Qatar.
And then they go, oh, these terrible people are taking over. We will have to intervene to prevent this.
Yeah.
And in other words, they're still talking of removing Assad. So that, you know, the General Dannett, Dumpling Dannett, as I call him, the former head of the British Army, saying, well, we'll have to get British boots on the ground if we're going to get rid of ISIS. And of course, and we'll have to get rid of Assad as well. I feel like saying, General, the Saudi Arab Army, the Syrian Arab Army has taken 60,000 casualties so far.
Fighting ISIS.
Trying to crush these largely non-Syrian rebels.
Yeah, exactly.
Is the British Army prepared to take 60,000 casualties? Because if you're not, perhaps you better just stick to football.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Well, what's quite interesting is some of the people that they recruited to fight in Syria were in fact from Yemen. And at the mm-hmm. time, US was dropping drones on Yemen to kill sort of Al-Qaeda. So people had a choice. You could either stay in Yemen and be killed by an American drone, or you could get paid and go and fight for ISIS in Syria.
The wider question here, both of you, is that this is actually Britain's responsibility as the former colonial power. Yeah. We're not intervening directly. We are probably, almost certainly, doing some sort of covert operations there. We've got our Saudi clients doing the job.
Yep,
so, Martin, what should be going on here in Britain?
Well, basically, we should be protesting about it insofar as it's possible to mobilise people about something so, you know, not directly connected with their immediate concerns. I think, to a large extent, these wars are being ramped up all over the place. The Ukraine, Latin America... everywhere this stuff is going on. And they're all linked. That's the point. And they're all linked through things like the Bilderberg Group, which we were discussing
absolutely.
At the beginning.
Yeah.
No doubt, the strategy in Yemen will be one of the workshops that they'll be
absolutely.
Pursuing. No doubt about it.
Yeah.
And I think what's being prepared here is a major offensive against Iran, Russia and China, ultimately. That's the big picture.
Yeah, I think so. But I think it's also quite interesting how the Houthis, they're really concentrating their fighting in the south, Aden, Taiz and Lahaj, and they're trying to sort of like control that area. But that is the area that the Americans, I'm sure, want yes. control of most. And I haven't ever spoken to any Houthi fighters, nor even any Houthi anybody that's a Houthi at all, as far as I know. But I'm sure that they're aware how they need to control that bit of Yemen.
Well,
Judith, Hadi was basically a US puppet
Absolutely.
Leader. Are the US actually directly involved at the moment?
Not officially, no.
No, they've got the ships.
But what they are doing is they're actually refueling Saudi aircraft.
Yeah.
They're providing the intelligence. And also, if any aircraft come down and any airmen need to be rescued, the Americans are rescuing them. So they do actually have some sort of roles. But if you ask them officially, no, they're not doing it.
But if they're selling And the Brits are selling the weapons to kill people.
Absolutely.
And then the US, and through satellites and things like that, are saying, well, drop a bomb there, drop a bomb there. They're intimately involved, even
absolutely.
Though they're trying to...
They are fighting. Yeah. They've also got a blockade around the coast, and Yemen's totally dependent upon imported food.
Yeah.
So the population is being starved.
It's being starved.
Which is completely completely illegal in international law, yeah. but that's what's going on.
And it's quite interesting, because when you talk to the people in Adenu, obviously they've had their house knocked down by a Houthi, as far as they're concerned. So they see the Houthis as their enemy. But when you're talking to them, they say, we haven't got any food because the Houthis are stopping it coming to us. But actually, the people in Sana'a and the people in other parts of him, even in the Hadramaut, where they're taking the IDPs, haven't got food. Because there's such a shortage of food, it's all going up in price so much.
Okay, just remind us, IDPs, what does that mean?
Internally displaced people.
So they're kind of refugees, basically.
Yeah, refugees, but in their own country, yeah. And at the moment, you see, people estimate it to be 1 million out of a 26 million population. I think it's far greater than that, because I don't know anybody in Yemen that I've spoken to that either hasn't left their home or isn't sheltering other people within their home. I mean, you see pictures of IDPs living in drains. They've got these big drains in Sana'a to take the water away when it's raining. Obviously, it isn't raining at the moment, so they're sheltering in those drains. And you see people in sort of like half knocked down buildings, half built up buildings. People that I know they're letting a family live in one room of their house, whereas maybe they might have four families living in their house instead of just their own family. So people are just sort of like incredibly cramped up. I mean, my best friend is living in a house in Tarim. She's now displaced. She's got a very small flat. There were three families altogether that came to share it with her. So there was 18 people living in a one-bedroom flat. So they've managed to rent one room now. So the men are all living in a rented room, and then they're living in this flat. Included in this party is a 108-year-old woman who's been disrupted at that stage of her life and is actually still alive. But it's just, it's just like a whole tragedy. If people have lost their homes, then they've lost their whole life, their whole security. If people have lost their education in the middle of their university course, that means that they can't get a job outside Yemen. Tragically, I know a girl who was due to take her finals as a dentist this year. She studied for 5 years. Her university has been bombed, so there's no verification, and she hasn't passed her finals. So she's now ineffectively unemployable after studying for that many years. I mean, these are just the ordinary stories of people's lives. I mean, I could tell you lots of other stories, but these are just the ordinary stories. It's how war upsets people's lives.
Martin, I'm reminded of this phrase, they're bombing them back to the Stone Age.
Well, that was used in the Vietnam War.
And in the Iraq War.
Yes. And of course, Vietnam had more bombs. North Vietnam had more ordnance dropped on it than were dropped on all sides by everybody in World War II.
Yeah.
And it's only a tiny place. But I mean, this just goes on and on and on. It's disgusting. The Russians have been quite clear, saying, look, what you should be calling for here is a ceasefire and negotiations. Mm. And that's what we call for in Bosnia.
Yep, absolutely.
That's what you call for in any of these situations. For goodness sake, stop shooting and let's try and sort it out.
Absolutely.
But of course, that is not the policy in Ukraine, Yemen, Syria or anywhere else. The people running the West are vicious warmongers.
Well, Hadi is refusing to negotiate.
Well, if he's an American puppet, they should be telling him to negotiate.
Absolutely.
That's the way it works. Just as the Russians should be telling their proteges in East Ukraine to negotiate, and they have. That's exactly what they've told them to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I agree.
Okay, so we'll leave this subject. I wonder if there's anything last word you'd like to have on this, Judith, because you are the expert here, and on where you think this is heading.
Well, I don't know where it's heading, I think, Tony, but I don't see it as a good place. But I am posting regularly on Froome Stop the War website. I go around different places and find different interesting articles and post on. So if people want to follow Yemen, if they go onto the Froome Stop the War website, that's where I'm posting all of my articles at the moment.
And I wonder, Martin, whether you think, actually contacting your Member of Parliament or the London media to actually start covering this. this properly. Well, I think since it was an ex-British, I mean, you know, we're hearing 150 years. Yeah. This was our, so you know, it's our mess,
well,
basically.
Well, indeed, and of course, BAE Systems, who are such a big employer in Bristol, make their profits from the misery that is being created.
Actually, BAE isn't massive, but a lot of their jets use Rolls Royce engines and things. BAE is getting smaller and smaller in Bristol, Filton.
Well, the point is that is ultimate. Everything is connected to everything else.
But absolutely, they are certainly represented at the Bilderberg, through Cheryl Cowper Coles and other people. Mm. Anyway, Dr. Judith Brown, thanks very much for joining us again on The Politics Show.
Thank you.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
And there's some other stories now. Martin, just before we go into those, Cuba, Revolution, Solidarity and Palestine. This is a meeting taking place on Thursday the 18th of June. Oh, hang on, no. Yes, it's Thursday the 18th of June from 7 p.m. to 9:30 at the Palestinian Museum Centre, which is 27 Broad Street. And we had some of the people who are going to be speaking there on a few weeks ago to discuss this. But this is really looking at the fact that Che Guevara actually did do a visit to Palestine in 1959. Just why was that so significant, and who was Che Guevara?
Well, Che Guevara is fairly famous. Many people have heard of him.
But who was he? What did he do? Why is he famous?
Well, he was
a lot of people have heard the name.
He was an Argentinian doctor. Who, and there's a film, The Motorcycle Diaries, which was on general release. He went off as a young man to ride around Latin America on a motorbike, and he saw so much poverty and misery that he came back to Argentina determined to become a revolutionary. And then
pick up a gun.
Yes, and he then was recruited by Castro in Mexico for his expedition to overthrow Batista in 1959, and he became, you know, one of Castro's right-hand men, and then the Cuban Revolution was successful, and then the Cubans then and now continue to support other countries around the world who are fighting imperialism as they see it.
I mean, there's quite a lot of regions of Europe and the United States that are sort of saying, well, we want less and less to do with the centre. I mean, we've got the United States of America based in Washington. We've got what is becoming a kind of United States of Europe based in Brussels. And various people, I'm thinking particularly about the Catalonians, for example, in Spain, they've had enough of being controlled by the centre because they can see themselves paying loads of taxes to a bunch of crooks.
Well, it's more complex than that. There's actually massive literature on what is imperialism. But effectively, if you think about the way the banking system works, countries are run into debt, usually by dictators. In Argentina, a classic case, the military dictatorship racked up masses of debts to pay for its various nefarious activities. And then when you finally manage to drive them out and get some kind of semi-democratic system in place, those debts are your debts. And that means, of course, that democratic governments are hamstrung. And This is the pattern all over the world.
The talk, I think, from memory, is £5 or £8, and also there'll be dancing and music and things like that afterwards, and some food. But just to remind you again, it is on Thursday, the 18th of June. That is next Thursday from 7 p.m. to 9:30 at the Palestinian Museum Centre, 27 Broad Street. Here in the centre of Bristol. And also other stories. Martin, we've had lots this week, haven't we? In the run-up to the Bilderberg, George Osborne was at the Mansion House giving a great speech about how he's going to change our whole financial architecture and infrastructure, followed by the great man himself, the God of Money. This is Mark Carney from the Bank of England.
Yeah, well, I have to laugh, because the Tories are proposing that they will pass laws which will make it impossible to raise taxes. So in other words, you know, in the past, governments made decisions to raise taxes depending upon, you know, the circumstances that they faced and whether it made sense to raise them or not. They didn't say in advance what they were going to do too much because the circumstances change. They're now going to set it in stone that they're not going to raise taxes. And they're also going to set it in stone that in normal times, whatever they are, we're going to balance the budget and we're not going to run any kind of deficit. It's like passing a resolution that there should be a warm summer and we don't want any rain, please. Because in actual fact, of course, that's how useful these kind of things are. But the other thing that makes me laugh about it is these two things are absolutely contradictory. If you got to a situation where the deficit was rising, then you'd say, well, we'll need to raise taxes to pay it off, but they've already passed a law saying you can't raise taxes. So which law are you going to obey? The law that says you're going to reduce the deficit, or the law that says you're not going to raise taxes? And in any case, all of this is utterly misconceived. It's like trying to say, I'm going to drive a car, and I'm never going to go more than less than 10 miles an hour or more than 40. But we don't know where we're going or how we're going to get there or what we're going to meet.
Well,
on the
other
way.
Announcement was that George Osborne is saying that he's going to sell off this big stake in Royal Bank of Scotland at a loss. But he's got approval for that from the N.M. Rothschild and Son, who've done an independent in inverted commas report, and Mark Carney.
Well, that's an independent report by Rothschild, who will snap up the shares. You see, what's happened there is that the shareholders of RBS have been paid off to the tune of billions of pounds, and now we're not going to get that money back by selling the bank at what its real value was or what we paid for it. So in other words, the wealthy, who are the investors and shareholders in RBS, will get a double whammy win. They got bought out at full price in the first place, and they shouldn't necessarily have been bought out at full price
allow the shares to slide down to maybe 1% of what they were.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're going to buy something, why not wait till the shares slide and then buy them? Yeah, they bought them out at a fair price, supposedly, and then the idea is we're going to get this money back. Now, we're not going to get this money back. Now, the amount of money involved is exactly the same as the amount of money they're trying to cut from the welfare budget. So the poorest people in the country are going to pay for the mistakes of the bankers, and the bankers, far from being made to pay, are going to be given a taxpayer handout, a massive taxpayer handout. They've already been given one, now they're going to be given another one. And it couldn't be clearer. This is not capitalism, it's not the free market, it's class war by an oligarchy on the rest of the population.
But it's
and because
not
they control the media, they've been able to bamboozle their way back into power. But their intentions are obvious. They are simply lining the pockets of their wealthy supporters at the expense
of the
rest of
society. It wasn't Osborne that decided to buy these RBS shares at the top price. Alistair Darling,
indeed,
and it was Gordon Brown.
Indeed, it is, but Osborne and Cameron supported
them. That was the main
them.
Mistake, wasn't it? That was
the
big mistake.
Oh, yes.
Surely to buy shares that are worth tuppence for £500 a piece, I mean, I'm sure that's not what RBS is, but something like that. That was Labour politicians decided to do it.
At the time, you see, what happened is everybody...
The opposition wasn't running the country, Martin, was it, at the time?
No, but they supported what Labour were doing. If Labour had said, right, we're not going to bail them out, or we're going to buy them at a much lower price, or we really are going to... I mean, at one stage, they're saying they're not nationalising the bank, they're just buying the shares. Now, in other words, they're running away from the reality that the financial services sector only survived then because of government intervention, and only survives now because of government intervention.
What they reckon is that they've lost round about £12 billion in the RBS bailout.
But surely, if we're going to lose £12 billion, then the principle should be that the people who didn't cause the crisis shouldn't have to pay for it. In other words, taxes might have to be raised on all wealthy people to cover that £12 billion. Because all of them have been protected by quantitative easing. And, of course, the logic of quantitative easing is having zero interest rates, which we have now for over 5 years. You only have zero interest rates in a crisis. Now, in other words, we've still got zero interest rates, so there is still a crisis. Now, at some point, interest rates are going to rise because governments don't ultimately control interest rates, no matter how hard they try. And as soon as interest rates rise, the whole pack of cards is coming down, and we're all going to war, not just in Yemen.
Another story this week. Ministers are treating unemployment as a mental problem. This was on the BBC, although they've since changed the headline. That was yesterday. Unemployment's being rebranded by the government as a psychological disorder, a new study claims. Those that do not exhibit a positive outlook must undergo reprogramming or face having their benefits cut, says the Wellcome Trust Bank report. This can be humiliating for job seekers and does not help them find suitable work, some of the researchers say. But the Department for Work and Pensions said there's no evidence to back up the highly misleading claims. A paper published in the Medical Humanities Journal says benefit claimants are being forced to take part in positive thinking courses in an effort to change their personality.
Well, this is a more extreme version of what's been going on for a long time. The idea that we had full employment in this country from 1945 to around 1975. they should be virtually anybody who wanted to work could work. The decision not to have full employment was taken by the Conservative government in 79, and we've always had more than a million people out of work since then. Now, in those circumstances, to blame the individuals concerned for not having jobs is perverse.
Job seekers are bombarded with motivational text messages such as "success is the only option," "we're getting there," and "smile at life," and have to take part in what they called, in inverted commas, pointless team building exercise such as building towers out of paperclips.
Well, indeed. I mean, and of course, all of this costs money. The cheapest thing to do when people are unemployed is pay them a benefit and let them sort themselves out. Attempts to reform their behaviour are actually expensive. But and the whole, all of this stuff is then creates new entrepreneurial opportunities for A4E and other organisations.
But if you take away their money so people can't afford basic things like toilet paper, doesn't that motivate them to get a job?
No, it doesn't. What it does is it sucks demand out of particularly poor communities and ultimately tips the economy over. I'm quite sure that Osborne's cuts are going to put the economy on the back foot. I'm quite sure they will. And the property market will burst, and then unemployment will rise, and then the deficit will go up, even though they've passed a law against it. Because the deficit went up in 2008, even though the government didn't want the deficit to go up, because the tax base collapsed as all these companies crashed. And, of course, that's what's going to happen again, but on a bigger scale.
Too poor to die, how funeral poverty is surging in the UK. This is in The Guardian on Tuesday. The manager of a North Liverpool credit union recently told me, says Dawn Foster, writing in The Guardian, that the most shocking fallout of the recession and austerity was the sheer volume of people calling because they were unable to bury their loved ones. People call from the hospital because they can't pay the £1,000 to get the undertakers to release the body, she said.
Well, that's the kind of country we're turning into. But it's not acceptable, and something will have to be done about it. And of course, it's very difficult for the people on the receiving end to fight back. They are struggling just to survive. Those who are on a slightly higher rung, as it were, who are not completely in the deep doo-doo, should show solidarity with those people, and we have got to show some resistance to this inhuman, absolutely ridiculous policy that's being pursued from the top.
The sharp rise in funeral poverty is one of the grimmer trends in our unequal island. In the past decade, funeral costs have risen by 80%, but wages haven't. The average funeral now costs £3,163 nationally and nearly £5,000 in London. If you're on a low income, the cost of a sudden death is far beyond your modest means, and life insurance can seem like an unnecessary luxury when you're struggling to heat your home.
Indeed. So let's go back to paupers' graves, eh? Roll on the 19th century.
There was another infographic from Harry Ripped Off Britain, which is a Twitter account, and also they do stuff for The Guardian. And it showed that actually out of the 10 poorest areas in the whole of Europe, 9 of them were in Britain. Only one was in Belgium. Britain actually isn't doing very well, is it?
No, it's not. But of course, the propaganda is that the economy has turned round and everything is on the up and up. But of course, it's all based on zero interest rates and quantitative easing and a massive property bubble, which allows the wealthy classes for their assets to rise in value on paper. So there's a massive income stream going in that direction. Meanwhile, the people on the bottom of the pile are persecuted, basically. Persecuted.
Okay, so let's go to Prime Minister's questions this week. I've just got one for you, and that is Angus Robertson, who's asked the questions after rather limp, I'm afraid, Harriet Harman this week, talking about minimum wages.
Mr. Angus Robertson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker.
The UK remains in the top 10 amongst the most unequal societies in the world. Helping people on low incomes receive the living wage can be transformational for them and their families. Will the Prime Minister take the opportunity to praise all employers who deliver the living wage?
I'm very happy to praise all those employers who deliver the living wage. That has long been the Conservative position. It's set out in the manifesto. And I'm proud to say that, as Prime Minister, and I hope this isn't gloating, number 10 is a minimum wage employer too, a living wage employer too.
As I should point out to the Right Honourable Gentleman, is this House a living wage employer as well?
Sorry, Martin, there was a little interjection by the Speaker right at the very end there, saying that the House of Commons is a living wage employer, apparently.
Well, the hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue, that's all I can say.
What do you mean by that?
When people start saying that they're in favour of a living wage, it makes me sick, because in actual fact everything else they're doing is pushing in the opposite direction. And people like to think well of themselves, don't they?
Okay, Martin, the time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. We'll be back with more Bilderberg, the big conference taking place in Austria that's deciding our fate after the news.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.